So, what we're going to do today is what we're going to do last week, which is focus in on Kevorkian and assisted suicide. But to get there, I have a few things to talk about. One is a definitional set of questions about what is euthanasia. We've touched on them a few times here, but I want to come back to them again because I want to make sure everybody gets some of the key distinctions between assisting someone in dying, which Kevorkian was more or less about, versus other things that go on. I want to spend a little bit of time going over some issues around the apparently simpler, but in fact deceptively not simpler, issue of do not resuscitate, which has its own complexities, which sort of lay the groundwork for thinking about withdrawing or not doing certain things to people. I've got a, hopefully, you guys stayed on the emails and looked at Blackboard. So there are some readings that came out. We're going to do one of our favorite class exercises after the break. I'm going to ask you to take a look at opposition to the proposal in Massachusetts to create a physician-assisted suicide law, somewhat like Oregon and Washington's. And that's what was up on Blackboard, and that's what the readings were. The other thing that was interesting this week, if you noticed, is that there weren't any readings about Kevorkian because Kevorkian was debated as a media event. It was much more an issue that was debated in the popular media than he was. It's not that no one ever wrote articles about Jack Kevorkian, but the arguments about what he wanted to do were very much sort of engaged in popular public arenas. And so that's why I tried to give you some clips about what people were saying, what movies had appeared about him, and so on. It was an interesting area where sort of public attitudes dominated over the academic ones. And that hasn't been true historically in bioethics debates. There's been a little more, they get kicked around by the academic side and then sort of spill out into public discussion. But with the media paying more attention to bioethics, which may be a good thing, it also means that debates can start in the media and stay in the media, and they don't actually necessarily get influenced by what academics might write, because the academics are following behind the debate now. So they might have to catch up to it as opposed to setting the terms of it. But before I do all that, I'll tell you where I went because it's relevant to sort of think about the role of bioethics in public policy. So I went last week to a place called the Royal Society, which is kind of like the National Academy of Sciences for England. And it was set up in 1600 and something by Isaac Newton. They founded it as a place to not just talk about science, but to do science. And the motto of this place is nothing just in words, which is offensive to me. But what they wanted was demonstrations of experiments to be done at the Royal Society. So if you had something that you thought was true, you had to come and do the experiment. So this is a little before journals began to say, well, you do the experiment, you write it up, you give us the methods, and then somebody could follow your recipe and replicate. Here, there weren't any journals. So you had to come in front of a jury of your peers, so to speak, and run the experiment in front of them. And that's what a lot of the Royal Society experiments consisted of, was doing things like Hooke and his studies of springs and the physics of springs and what kind of force they could generate, stuff. They're all demonstrated in front of everybody else at the Royal Society. So it's not an old place. It's been rebuilt. I think it was blown up in World War II, among other things. But it looks newer, but it has all kinds of little treasures. And in the Easter season, or for those who have strong religious feelings, this is somewhat science's little holy place of relics. They don't have little thumbs of Isaac Newton or, you know, a bit of bone from Hooke. But what they do have is, you know, the little holy manuscript of Newton's laws and the little sort of iconic stand where Priestley expanded gases and this sort of stuff. It's very funny because it's this far away from a religious cathedral. I mean, it's just, and everybody is sort of, you know, you have to talk in hushed terms. same signs that are up at the, say, Chartres Cathedral are kind of up at this place. There's a, have to have good decorum. Might want to wear a tie to look at Newton's writings. They don't see it that way, but I sort of felt that when I was there. And it is a group that is, you'll sometimes see people have FRS after their name, Fellow of the Royal Society, you get elected. So very quickly, a meeting was put together at this place to talk about the issue of engineering flu viruses to make them either more transmissible or more virulent. So nastier or easier to get, or both, actually. You could do both. And the occasion for this meeting was two groups of scientists, one in Wisconsin, which is sort of an American-Japanese collaborative team, and one in the Netherlands, both with, Netherlands-American collaboration, both with NIH money, had submitted papers independently, one to Science and one to Nature, saying that they had found that by changing certain genes, you could make pandemic flu virus that's around in birds transmissible in ferrets. Ferrets are like minks. Now, you might say, so, you know, that's nice. But the ferret-to-ferret thing means mammal-to-mammal transmission, which means human-to-human. And so the idea was, by changing certain genes, you could make a flu virus easy to give from human-to-human activity, and in this case by respiratory droplets, sneezing, coughing, spitting, that kind of thing. So that made it of concern to the NIH, who looked at it and said, wait a minute, this might be used by bad guys to make bad bugs and make them weaponizable. You could turn them into weapons by converting a flu virus into a much easier to transmit thing. So the NIH sent it off to a group that I didn't even remember existed called the National Safety Advisory Biology Board, NSABB, which was created probably 10 years ago after somebody published the genetic information about how to make smallpox. And they're supposed to kind of weigh these kind of papers and decide whether they want to see them get published or think they ought to be censored. Now, they never in 10 years have recommended anything be censored, but they looked at these two papers and recommended that they either be not published or censored a lot, meaning pulling back the recipe to how to make the bad bug and some of the findings about what the genes were that would lead to more easy transmission. And then everybody went crazy. Anybody read about this in the media? So this is the, should we publish, kind of the Death Star formula for viruses. And there's been a slew of media fighting. The recommendation came in December to not publish. The two research teams said, you're crazy. The editors of Science and Nature got involved and said, how dare you tell us what we can publish? The National Science Advisory Biology Board doesn't have any authority over our journals. You know, you can recommend whatever you want, but we decide what we publish. We have free speech. We have a right to inquiry. We are free. Herman Cain was, you know, in the background. We're free. Everyone must be free. We're free to say what we want. Free, free, free. And the State Department and the Dutch government said, if you publish, you would have to send these papers overseas to the British Journal, or in the case of the United States, you would need to use ink and paper and stuff. And we're shutting down any access to that stuff on grounds of national security. So their government agencies got into this. And then various newspapers began writing about the doomsday bug and the formula to, you know, is it right to kill everybody? You can look on websites when you leave today if you're interested in this. The Guardian has, in England, has a huge website thing of all kinds of opinions and descriptions of what the research is. There was an article last week about this in the New Yorker. So lofty media paid attention to it, tabloid media paid attention to it, all kinds of newspaper stuff. And newspaper people and media people tended to be really attracted to the idea that there was something they couldn't publish, which instantly makes them interested in publishing it, I can tell you. So they don't like censorship. That's not, doesn't sit well with any media outlet. Eventually, after a lot of jawboning, the researchers agreed to a moratorium and said, okay, we'll wait 60 days from January 1st before we publish for people to look at this and debate it, and then we'll sort of work with the editors and decide what we're going to do. After the 60 days, that board met again, and they were given a revised version of the paper, which explained a little more about how the things were made and some other details, but said more clearly that in transmitting these viruses between ferrets, none of the ferrets had died, which made the board feel that maybe they had shown something about transmissibility, but they hadn't shown anything about lethality or making it nastier or more virulent. So they changed their mind and said, you can publish. And our meeting took place a week after that with everybody on board, the editor of Science, the editor of Nature, the scientists were there from Wisconsin and Holland. There were at least 7 Nobel Prize winners who came to this thing, various fellows of the Royal Society and other eminences. Who else was there? There were some journalists invited from the Washington Post and public radio. It was a high-powered group. They had about 25 people come, and I got asked to summarize the meeting. I was the last speaker. Well, so what does this all boil down to? So that was a weird role for bioethics. Normally I get to open the meeting and say, I don't know what's going on. There's a lot of questions. There are many difficult things, but here I had to sort of say, well, you know, I've listened to all this. So they had bioethics in the role almost of a judge, as opposed to a Socratic questioner, which was very unusual. There were 2 other bioethics people there, one John Harris, who runs the program at Manchester, and a guy named Russ Upshur, who used to run the center at Toronto. Russ knows something about flu. He's a physician, and I know he did work on respiratory diseases. Harris didn't have much background in any of the relevant things, but I think he'd been on committees in England with some of these other people, so he got invited. So the bioethics trial was not overwhelmingly informed with the facts. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about how what I learned there and sort of what I said at the end, although the whole thing is going to be webcast next week. I think they're going to put the whole thing on board. So this is an example of how facts interact with normative views. So when I showed up at the meeting, I'm thinking, I came with a bias. I thought we should censor these papers. It would be very bad to put dangerous information up where any terrorist organization could use it to engineer bad pandemic flu. The last pandemic wasn't so bad, but if you could make it easier to catch and meet nastier, that would be bad. And so we should not publish these papers, or at least we should pull out some of the key details and only let maybe people with a need to know or some special clearance see the details. And I kept thinking, what kind of loon would want to publish this stuff anyway? So I met the loons at the meeting when the 2 lead scientists were there. Their teams weren't there, but the heads of their teams were there. Facts. One fact. Flu. So almost all flu comes from animals. We all know that, right? It starts in animals, incubates, and then jumps into other animals, and eventually gets to us. The animals that seem to be the most interested in flu are birds. And wild birds are absolutely the carriers of the flu virus that ultimately gives us the flu. Ducks, geese, and if you want to get the flu, or have a pretty good chance of getting virulent flu, drink pond water with a lot of birds in it. Plenty of flu virus in those birds. However, the flu that they get is not flu that infects us necessarily directly. It usually has to get transmitted in one group that goes from wild birds to domestic birds. So one of the huge problems of the flu is that it kills a lot of chickens. I mean billions. Countries get wiped out of their poultry production because they get bird flu from wild birds to domestic birds. When the flu goes from one species of bird to another, it often mutates. And the more it's changing, the more there's a chance that it might be able to infect not just domestic birds, but also things like pigs or ferrets. I got to tell you this side story. So I've been interested in vaccines for a long time, which is probably why I got asked to this meeting, but I never really got the whole story on the ferret. Who studies ferrets? I mean, nobody studies ferrets. What is with a ferret? The only people who study ferrets are people who have them as pets. Anybody have a pet ferret here? They're nasty, too. I mean, they bite you. And vaccine scientists, flu scientists. Well, it turns out in 1933, some British guys were studying distemper, and they had a ferret that had distemper, and they were trying to study it. And figure out what was causing distemper. The kind of thing that, you know, your dog might get a distemper shot for today, same animal disease. Anyway, they didn't get an answer to that, but one of the guys got a really bad case of the flu. And he thought, I wonder if I got it from this ferret. So they killed the ferret and found some weird agent, the flu virus, and thought, I bet that's where I got the flu from. And then they tried to infect another guy in the same lab who hadn't gotten the flu, and he did get the flu. And all of a sudden, they got the answer to the fact that maybe the flu was caused by a virus. So it was kind of an accident that they were fooling around with ferrets. But then they had to answer the question, how did they get the flu from a ferret? Nobody had sex with the ferret. Nobody kissed the ferret. Nobody did anything intimate with the ferret, so there wasn't anything happening there. Nobody had eaten the ferret. So how did they get it? Well, it turns out the ferret has a wonderful property. It sneezes.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's how they got it. And it's one of the few animals that sneeze. If you try to study flu communicability, mice don't sneeze. Rats don't sneeze. Pigs don't sneeze, as far as I know. But this thing sneezes and will cough. And so that's why the ferret is the star of flu land. I could stop here and say that was really worth going to England to find out about, but but it was interesting. I finally got an answer. What is with this ferret thing? It's partly an accident. Partly it's one of the few animals that will sneeze and airborne up disease microbes and give them to one another, ferret to ferret, too. In birds, they tend to pick it up in the gut, and it changes in the gut, mutates, percolates, and then passes on through feces to the next species, that sort of thing. To get up to us, you either have to eat it or really be in close contact with the birds, which you know happens in a lot of markets around the world, or you've got to get some kind of moisture. But once it gets, that's why it's hard to get from the animals to us, because most of these animals aren't sneezing on us. And for most animals, if you eat them, your digestive juices kill the human ones, will kill the bird ones. But if you're handling poultry all day long, you can get stuff on you, or if it's not clean, and if you look at the poultry industry in Bangladesh and Vietnam and Indonesia, it tends to be the places where the birds are close together, the hygiene isn't the best, and that's where you're getting cases into humans. When cases into humans happen, there are probably about 400 or 500 deaths, but they don't go human to human because the virus has not mutated into a form where you could communicate it through coughing or sneezing or spitting. So there are deaths from avian flu every year, but they're usually in the hundreds. They're usually in Southeast Asia or China or Hong Kong, places with big public markets, stacked up poultry, a lot of hand contact, sleeping near the animals, that sort of thing. And that's sort of what the limit is on the flu. But every once in a while, one of those bugs mutates and it becomes possible for a human to give it to another human. And that's pandemic. So that's what they were worried about with H1N1, the swine flu thing. Occasionally, it goes through pigs. Same problem, it'll kill the pigs. A lot of close contact with pigs, so you can get swine flu, which is bird flu through pigs into us. But you're watching the mutations all the time to see if it gets easier to transmit depending on what animals it's been through. And what the scientists had done is by breeding ferrets and giving them the flu virus, it's called passing through, exactly what you think, and letting them sneeze on each other as the thing, they waited long enough and then seen a couple of mutations and realized that was something that was going to be transmissible to people and then easy to go from people to people. They didn't study people to people, but they knew that the changes that had taken place were exactly the same ones they saw in the H1N1 pandemic flu back from 2 years ago. So they occurred naturally. People had been wondering, how likely is it for this to happen again? Last time through, it wasn't that virulent. I mean, people died, but it wasn't that bad. But they're always sort of nervous that at any point a mutation could happen and you get transmissibility of this human-to-human type flu contagion. Well, it's not so easy, but it's not so hard, is the bottom line. They found a set of mutations, I think there were three, that made this particular strain highly transmissible. But there are other possibilities that they, you know, combinations that might do it too. This is just one they found that did make it human transmissible. It's not the only one. So you could, if you were of a mind, sit around and try to engineer animals to make this flu and make something more transmissible, although it wouldn't necessarily be nastier. Other changes involve how nasty the flu is, whether it kills you or just makes you a little sick. And they didn't do that. Neither of these teams had done that. So, a couple of other facts that I learned. This was kind of funny. So I came in ready to say, nope, don't publish, censor this, ruin their careers, stop doing this, this is all bad, too dangerous. Next thing I learned is, there is no way you can censor these papers. The teams each have 30 people or 40 people just working on the team, and they're sending emails all day long back and forth about what they're doing and the details of the work, and any hacker could get in there and find their stuff in a day. In fact, it's an invitation. If you said, we're going to censor this, then people say, let's go in the cloud and find it. I mean, every 17-year-old would be, I bet I could find the details of what they were doing. They don't encrypt. They don't control. I mean, aside from the 30 people exchanging information, they're sending it out to their buddies. There might be somebody somewhere they want their view about it from a virologist somewhere. So a lot of the stuff is up in the cloud. A lot of the stuff is in their computers itself. Nothing's protected. The notion of censoring or redacting, as it's called, part of the paper, forget it. I talked to a bunch of cyber, they had a couple of cyber experts there. It was like, absolutely not, unprotectable. And what I learned was basically, I mean, we all kind of know this is true, but it really is true. Unless you're encrypting from the get-go upstream, there is no, by the time you're ready to publish a paper, a zillion people know what's in it. It's too late. The only way you could control it is to block or put restrictions on at the start of the experiment as to who could see it, where they could send information, how they could send that information. You'd probably have to set up the equivalent of a weapons lab like we have at Fort Detrick or that place in Utah. There's another proving ground out there that Jonathan actually knows more about than I do, where they test chemical weapons and stuff. But if you don't start with intense security at the beginning, by the time somebody's written the paper up and sent it to a journal, it's like so late in the game as to be silly, funny. I mean, it was, so that isn't going to happen. It's just, you may rethink the need to do this research and who should do it and so forth. Second thing I learned, this is facts again. Yeah, bad guys might want to get this virus, but there is a fact, which is that if you did create pandemic flu that was easy to transmit and very bad, you'd kill all your own people, in addition to everybody else. So it's not the world's best weapon, flu. You like weapons that kill people that you aim them at, but don't kill you too, generally speaking. So if you want to weaponize things, giving people bugs that for some reason only affect your enemies is a nice idea, or that you could spray on a population and keep it there, anthrax, that's not so bad. But flu, you're going to kill, you're as likely to kill people in your home place as you are people you don't like. It's not the world's best weapon. But what it is of interest is to people who are just plain crazy, who want to end the world. That's a different problem. You know, it's sort of an end of times kind of Jim Jones, let's all die together kind of thing. That would be of interest. So then the question arose, well, how secure are the places where you did these experiments? And these experiments are done in what are called level 4 biosafety labs. I feel like I should get Jonathan back in here because some of this is his turf about the national security work. But a level 4 biosafety lab is pretty secure. It has airlocks and chemical washes for anybody who goes in and out. Nothing that's alive in there is ever allowed out without being radiated or blacklighted or something to kill it. So nothing alive leaves in terms. There are separate water supplies, separate air supplies. The police patrol the place in Wisconsin pretty regularly. So it's a somewhat secure lab. But I wound up saying at the meeting, I'm not impressed. How many labs you want to build? Who should do this work? There are bio level 4 labs being proposed in many countries around the world, some of which, if I name them, you might say, I'm not so sure how good they are at security. So whether you want to license these places or allow people to have 12 of them in the United States or 200 of them in the United States, because everybody gets interested in bioengineering, or whether you want to say, no, they're going to be secure like the national labs, or more of a weapons kind of an approach to where you can do the work. MIT has a place called Lincoln Labs, for example. It just does national security research and much, much more restricted than anything at MIT. You don't go in and out of there without a clearance and all kinds of hoops to jump through. And they don't publish anything. There's also one other group that doesn't publish things pretty willingly, which I had to remind my friends at the Royal Society. Industry. When they were all getting worked up about the free exchange of information, I said, gee, I don't know, last time I looked, the guys who invented software for Microsoft weren't just publishing it in journals. They work to get paid, and they have patents and trade secrets and stuff. So it isn't really true that everything and anything has to be available. That's just the ethos of the academic scientists. But you might have a whole national security kind of bioweapons set up and restrict who can be there. When we got around to things like Katrina and the Japanese nuclear reactor, and what if somebody mounted an assault on your lab to just break it down? I didn't get great answers to that. So what wound up happening was this. I came with a normative view. Censor it, redact it, control the information, don't let it out to just anybody. Answer to that, factually, completely impossible to do. You can't do it. It's too late. If you want to control this kind of work, you have to go upstream, set limits on who can do it early, where they could do it. You may want to restrict what they can publish from these places, but you'd have to do it way, way, way upstream. Much more danger from a leak, an accident, or a nut than is a weapon. All this stuff online that I looked at, newspaper stuff about weapons, it's not a great weapon. They're better. There are easier ways to go after your enemies than weaponizing the flu. It's just not that interesting. But accidents, Katrina type, you know, there's an earthquake. I looked at the University of Wisconsin building. It's a nice building, but I'm not sure it would stand up to the right tornado or hurricane. I don't know. I'm just, it looked like a pleasant enough little building, but I'm not sure it was built to withstand every, you know, scenario anybody could come up with about knocking the crap out of there. And if the stuff came out of there, it would not be a good thing. So more accident and controlled environment. So that's how the meeting went, and I know that's a long description, but it was interesting for a couple of reasons. You can clearly see the fact-norm interaction, right? The sort of, I have this belief, control the information, factually that won't hold. You can't, I mean, at the point of publication. the freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry stuff was kicked around. It's not true. Industry keeps many secrets. So do militaries all over the world. There are plenty of people who don't publish as the first priority. It may be an academic virtue, but it isn't necessarily the virtue of science wherever it appears. The notion that this is going to be used by enemies for bioterror, not this. I think that was misunderstanding. The notion that, oh, and why would nuts do this? Well, the reason to do it is if you can then do surveillance on birds or people, you might see the same mutations happening, and then you might know that an epidemic was coming. So there is a good guy aspect to this. You can monitor sample flu from dead birds, domestic ones or wild ones, or from dead people, and say, oh, this is mutating and it's changing just along the lines that we got in the ferrets. That's bad. And if you saw that, you could also then begin to try and make vaccine for that strain of flu a little bit earlier. There are other problems because making vaccine fast is hard to do, but you might get a few weeks lead time if you knew something was coming. So that's what the good guys would do with the information, and that's really why these two science groups were interested. They weren't interested in making weapons. They were interested in sort of coming up with early warning information that you could apply. So it was all pretty interesting. Questions were good. There was a lot of yelling and screaming. Boy, nothing like censorship to get people really wound up, and they were wound up. I think at the end of the day, it was interesting, too, to see that bioethics got a seat at the table. I still don't quite understand why. I mean, I wasn't knocking it until I got there and they said, you're the concluder. Then it was a little more than I seated at the table would be good, but I would have been happy to stay at the kiddie table instead of the grown-up table, much less have to give the benediction on the whole stupid thing. It was important to... one good thing that I had was I had worked on vaccine issues and some of them pertaining to flu, so I didn't sound like an absolute moron in talking to the rest of them. You don't get a lot of slack as the ethicist if you're not up on the science of what's being discussed. People will be polite, but pretty soon you're going to get... That's what happened to my friend John Harris, the guy who was there from Manchester. He didn't know the stuff, and he kind of got put on the side pretty fast. So even if you don't know the stuff, you should lie and try to pretend that... No, you should... it's good to bone up a little bit if you don't know it. It's better still if you know a little bit about it so you can ask questions that aren't completely crazy. So I tell you this in part because you know what we're doing next week? We're taking a look at the critique of bioethics. What's its role in society? What should it be doing? How does it evolve? This is clearly an example of working in a policy setting, but kind of a national security connection. That's really who the agencies are that are there. There's obviously a bioethics link to industry, and some people say you shouldn't talk to them, and other people say you should. I'm more in the you should camp, but there are certainly, we're going to read people next week who say, it corrodes and corrupts bioethics to intersect with, say, the pharmaceutical industry or the biotech industry. There may be others who would say it would corrode it to intersect with the military or national security. I've always found that mildly funny because the master's program has had plenty of students from both the military, pharmaceuticals, and biotech, so if we shouldn't be talking to them, we've got to revise our admissions policy here pretty soon. But you know what I mean, talking to them for pay, not just educational things. There's certainly other people who might say even working with medicine as it now stands in the United States is a bad idea because it's just an unethical form of medicine. Too many uninsured, too much money-making, too much sucking up to powerful interests. So I went through this little case example with you in part because we're going to come back next week to the historical evolution of thinking about where should bioethics interact? Who does it talk to? Or who is it okay to talk to? If there should be any censorship or restrictions or, if you will, intentional forbearance that we're not going to do certain things. Questions about all that?
Who would have had the decision-making authority?
To really publish these papers? The journal editors. Because they don't really, if the people who sent the papers were going to stick with it and say, you know, I'm going to send you this paper and let the NIH take my grant away, the National Advisory Board that they were talking to doesn't have the authority to stop them. They're advisory. The State Department might have tried to restrict the distribution of science outside the U.S., but it can't do it inside. The Dutch government was making threatening noises about restricting distribution outside of Holland. So there might have been, but publishing, probably the journal editors.
Could the Homeland Security, if they felt it was a bioterrorist threat, have come in and said no?
I don't know. State Department definitely has some export controls that they could trigger. I don't know what the National Secrecy Act is at the end of the day. I just don't know. But it was funny because the journal editors in this case had a lot of authority. It was funny. They had the manuscripts. They'd been submitted. So they already had seen something. And they'd been out for peer review, another group of people who'd already seen this stuff too, right? So by the time you're talking secrecy, it's a big... It's secret among everybody who doesn't need to know, is what I might say. It's sort of everybody who had a dim interest probably has seen these papers. If we went back, I'll give you a little hint about some of the who should bioethicists talk to. If you went way back in time, back to the Vietnam War era, there were plenty of people saying at that time that academics shouldn't talk to the military, period, end of story, warmongering, unjust war, don't do anything to support them. All kinds of people came in for criticism for doing work on napalm, chemists and so on. So you shouldn't make that kind of a weapon. It's a targeted, oftentimes winds up killing civilians. You might get a flavor of this about people critical of landmines, sort of saying they wind up killing many more civilians than they do combatants or potential combatants. There was a notion that the military was supporting an unjust, fighting an unjust war, and that academia should not have anything to do with it. Today, that role has been replaced by the pharmaceutical industry. They're not fighting unjust wars, they're just gouging you. And they're trying to bribe and dupe their way to extreme profits, often on the backs of poor people. They're escalating costs out of control, and every one of their companies has recalls and marketing scandals. They don't have any ethics in the whole industry. So they've become the new military. If I announced today that we were going to do work with Homeland Security to develop a policy on bioterror, I bet I wouldn't get three critical emails. So oh, that's good. Take it back to 1971, and I'd be getting a snow of emails saying, you're working with the fascist state? Why, that's, how could you, you know, stop doing that. That's just the worst you could do. Don't support that kind of thing. Post 9/11, different views about security, different views about military. I don't know that people were in love with the pharmaceutical industry back in the 1970s, but I can tell you this, it certainly had a much better reputation. Merck and Johnson & Johnson, there were companies that people looked up to. So they have integrity. They have good codes of ethics. They weren't Lilly. These are companies that made it high up on the top, you know, companies that have, I don't know what they call these surveys, but the highly respected companies. They're not there anymore. They're rattling around somewhere with, you know, undertakers and, I don't know, who else is a sleazy industry? Used car salesmen and, I mean, who? Yeah, so it's bad. They've fallen a long way. Some self-inflicted, some probably due to shifts in the culture about good guys and bad guys and that sort of thing. That's what I'm talking about in terms of a shift in history. It used to be government and military connections that triggered the most concern about who academics or bioethicists were talking to. Today, it's much more private industry. One bitter irony, before we get over to these definition things. The Gates Foundation is universally beloved, and people think it's great, and it's a wonderful foundation, and nobody really gripes too much if you get support from the Gates Foundation or work as an ethicist talking to the Gates Foundation. What's the irony? It's funded by the two biggest capitalists on the planet, Gates and Buffett, right? He has Coca-Cola money and Berkshire Hathaway money, and Bill Gates, I wouldn't exactly say, is uninterested in business. So these two corporate giants have pooled their resources to make the far and away the biggest foundation in the world. But as soon as you move it into the framework of a foundation, it's cleansed. I used to joke with a guy named Tachi Yamada, who was the medical director for many, many years at Glaxo. And he was hated and a fiend and a demon. And then he became the medical director for the Gates Foundation. And he was loved and kindly and a wonderful person. It happened overnight. It was like a butterfly kind of thing. So like, oh, he became beautiful. And there he was ugly and now he's good. The Gates Foundation is invested in all kinds of profit business things. That's where they get their money from. They're trying to grow the pot. And they're certainly more than willing to partner with any industry that might do them some good in achieving their mission, including, for sure, the pharmaceutical industry. They don't try to sell vaccines and move them around the world on their own. They talk to vaccine manufacturers who are all in pharma companies day and night. I mean, constantly. I've been to a lot of their meetings. I know they're there. So I'm not trying to demonize the pharma industry other than to describe the way some demonize it. But it is interesting, too, that most of the charity side, particularly Gates, but most of them, come out from capitalist success or business success. They don't. They have their roots back in these same sources. So if you're really going to avoid the business connection, you might have to be more thorough than just not the most active business earners right now. So anyway, something to think about for next week. All right, coming backwards toward today. Somebody tell me, what is that difference again between euthanasia and assisted suicide? Keep hammering this, but let's hammer it one more time. If you don't want to get really complicated, then I'll settle for what's euthanasia. Forget the difference. What does it mean to be involved in euthanasia?
So I think assisted suicide, you help someone else commit the act of suicide, giving them the medicine, but then they take it. Whereas euthanasia, you actually give medicine.
So one attribute of euthanasia is you deliberately kill another person actively. Euthanasia means to actively bring about the death of a person. So there can be some interesting twists on euthanasia. You can have voluntary euthanasia. Will you please kill me? You do the killing, they don't kill themselves, but they ask that you help them die. Somebody who's extremely paralyzed, ALS, end-stage Parkinsonism, locked-in syndrome, typing out something on their computer, they may not be able to kill themselves. They want you to do it. That's an instance of voluntary euthanasia, meaning the person who's going to be killed asks for it. Involuntary euthanasia, the person who's going to be killed explicitly says, "Don't kill me." And you kill them anyway. So you can have instances in which I say, I don't want to die. And somebody says, well, I think it'd be better off if you did. It gets awfully close to murder. But involuntary euthanasia, the difference is, in most murders, you're not doing it because you think it's in the best interest of the person. Euthanasia is killing done because it's in the best interest of the person to be dead, either because they think that's so and ask, or you think that's so and you kill them, even if they say don't do it. Occasionally you hear these things about the angels of mercy in the hospital. A nurse runs around and injects people. She thinks they're suffering a lot. We saw some of this maybe in the hospital in Katrina, where maybe the people didn't ask to be killed. Some of them may have said, don't kill me, but the nurse thought, or the doctor thought, I can't leave you here, you're going to suffer, I'm going to kill you. It's going to be better for you. Or you can make up a scenario like that. So as crazy as it sounds, there may be instances in which somebody explicitly says, I don't want to die, but you do cause them to die in an out of a sense that it's good or better if they do. So what distinguishes euthanasia, I'm not saying it would hold up in court, but what distinguishes it ethically is, in just murder or killing, you don't care what the interest is in the person. You're just getting rid of them or killing them for your own motive or whatever it is. You may kill them accidentally, manslaughter, kill them deliberately, plan a long time to kill them, all those degrees of murder. But you're not trying to say, and you wouldn't get in court and say, oh, well, you know, I did it because it was in their best interest. In euthanasia, that's what you're trying for. You're either saying, they asked me to do it, and I really felt that this instance of a killing made sense because they really did not want to live and they couldn't end their own life, so I helped them. Or, I think it'd be better if they died. They may say no, and you may not pay attention, may override it. You're going to suffer more in ways you don't understand, so I'm going to help you to die now. Or you may simply not know what their wishes are. I guess that's a, I'm not sure which word would describe that, but there may be instances in which you simply decide to do it without being certain what they would want. And that's another form of euthanasia as well. So my point is, characteristics of euthanasia are, it's involuntary. I mean, you might think of mass murder in concentration camps or medical murder as kind of the extreme end of involuntary. You know, I don't want to die, but I'm going to kill you anyway because it's in the best interest of the state. We don't want your kind around. That's a kind of involuntary euthanasia mass murder program. There could be involuntary euthanasia because you're really trying to think, however, what's in the best interest of this person in the long run, and it may not be to live in your view, not their view, but yours. You may not know what they want, decide to kill them anyway, or they may ask you, please help me to die. These are all cases in which a second party does it to someone else, and usually they will, if it's going to be a euthanasia claim, then it's going to be dressed up as for the benefit of the person who died, or for the benefit of the rest of us, that the person had to die. That's the eugenics thing, or maybe in an epidemic or something like that. But it isn't just, for my purposes, it's better that you're dead. That's murder or killing of a different sort. Assisted suicide. You're going to do the killing, but someone's going to help you get the means or give you information. So I might look on the web and see, this is how I could kill myself. I could use gas. I could go in a garage. I could put a baggie over my head, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't kill anybody. I just gave information. I'm assisting. It's up to you to go do it. So no second party does it. You have to do it. It's suicide with help. And if it's doctor admitted or provided information or assistance, I'm giving you chemicals, I'll give you a pill, I built a machine, like Dr. Kevorkian, his famous, anybody remember the name of his machine? The Thanatron? Gotta love it. It was like this Rube Goldberg thing, you hit this button, gas went, and jet, it was amazing. Built out of hardware parts. Anyway, if I am assisting as a doctor, it's physician-assisted suicide. But you can have assisted suicide by anybody. There are groups in Switzerland that tell you how to end your life. There were groups in the United States, the Hemlock Society, that provide information to people. So it doesn't have to, for suicide, you don't really have to go to medical school. You just may need the means. For some forms of suicide, you may need to go to medical school because you may need a prescription. But outside of that, it's not clear that doctors have to be involved. Or to turn this around, you could have nurse-assisted suicide. You could have pharmacist-assisted suicide if all you needed was somebody to give you the drugs. I guess you could have minister-assisted suicide or other bioethicist-administered suicide. I mean, you could have other subsets of people saying, I will get this information for you. But for the most part, the debate in the U.S. about assisted suicide has been a physician-assisted suicide debate. And that's really due to Jack Kevorkian. Jack Kevorkian felt very strongly that the duties and obligations of physicians included helping people to die who no longer wanted to live. That was part of a physician's duty or obligation, just as much as to try and relieve pain and suffering or to try and provide them with adequate information to preserve their health, you should also be willing, as a physician, to help people die. The reason being, it would be more humane and less messy. So physician-assisted suicide for him in part was having the training would help. It's part of what you should be willing to do to honor a person's request to end their life. And doctors do know a little bit about how to get forms of death that might be less painful or less messy for survivors. Nobody in medicine has ever endorsed that view. So the American Medical Association, the Canadian Medical Association, just about every medical association anywhere has said that is not part of our duty. We don't accept that. But Kevorkian, when he got the issue going, made it very much a physician-assisted suicide. I was always waiting for a debate to break out between people who thought they didn't like physician-assisted suicide, but they liked assisted suicide. That they didn't mind having people give you information from the Hemlock Society, or in Switzerland it's called Dignitas. I don't know what it is in other countries. There are other movements like this. They didn't see why you needed doctors. There's a certain kind of anti-doctor backlash that you might expect. You know, people say, I don't have to have doctors. I can do this myself. I just need information. Maybe I need access to certain means, but don't have to have doctors around. And conversely, the doctor groups kept saying, this puts us in a terrible light. We don't want to be seen as being willing to kill patients. What reason primarily would doctors not want to be seen as killing patients? And I don't mean going to jail. I mean from the patient point of view.
Trust.
So who's going to trust us if we're seen as being willing to kill them? Art Kaplan makes these nice distinctions between voluntary and involuntary, and they ask that we didn't, but people aren't going to trust us. They're going to think we just show up and we'll kill you if you didn't pay your bill, if you're threatening to get a lawyer, I don't know, whatever. There are a lot of reasons we might kill you.
Difficult patient,
boring patient, didn't read my article patient, whatever it is. So trust. Trust is essential to the doctor-patient relationship. The power or the willingness to kill a patient, even in dire circumstance or with a lot of pain and suffering, doctors can't go there. So Kevorkian wanted them to go there. He had a sort of narrow view of what physician duties were, and the medical profession, the organized medical profession, I should say nursing and physician extenders and everybody else, no professional group that I know of has bought in, even in Oregon and Washington. The Washington and Oregon medical associations opposed legalization of physician-assisted suicide. When it got legitimated, they played ball with it, but they fought it all the way. So did the hospice movement in Oregon. There was no... I always have to be careful to say this and say there's not any... There's almost no organized healthcare professional support for physician-assisted suicide. I won't say none. I can't think of any... I'm sure someone can drag out some medical group somewhere that said it, but it's really been 99% no, very strong against trust as the counter-argument, undermining of trust.
What about if it's couched in terms of the assisted suicide, if it's pitched as just, would the healthcare professionals...
Medicine, I will tell you, I think medicine has tended to be quiet about that. They could have come out and said, you know, in general... The one group that's an exception is psychiatry. Many psychiatrists believe any suicide is an instance of depression or mental illness. There are no rational suicides. I still think, we don't have any psychiatrists here, do we? I still think that's the official position of the American Psychiatric Association, that any suicide attempt is an indication of depression. So rational suicide... not something that mental health professionals necessarily have accepted. Outside of that, most of the rest of medicine hasn't really spoken up one way or the other about it, not gotten involved. Different places have tried to legalize physician-assisted suicide. You know about Washington State, you know about Oregon. Belgium and Holland and Luxembourg all have forms of physician-assisted suicide. Western Australia, one of the states in Australia, tried to legalize it, got defeated. Colombia in South America for a while had it legalized, and it got overturned in the parliament. There have been proposals rattling around about assisted suicide in many, many different states. Massachusetts is clearly thinking about putting an initiative on the ballot. Hawaii is probably going to put an initiative on the ballot. Montana had a state court ruling that said we don't see anything on our laws that prohibit this. It's not a positive policy, but it's one that seems to leave the door open to it without getting prosecuted. I think I told you before, looking back historically, prosecutors generally have been pretty reluctant to come after doctors, even when there is an allegation of physician-assisted suicide, and the same for nurses. Kevorkian had to struggle mightily to get ultimately arrested and convicted. He had to kill somebody on 60 Minutes. Anybody know the ironic connection there? Who was his interviewer? Mike Wallace, the guy who just died. Which got him in a bunch of trouble, by the way, because it was controversial to show this crime and sort of then broadcast it, which was its own journalism ethics thing about should Mike Wallace have put the show on at all, because the guy, Thomas Yelk, was killed. He filmed him and watched him get killed.
What's wrong with that?
I guess the idea was it was just unethical, not illegal, just unseemly, bad, encouraging other people, that sort of thing. Intrusion into private moments. Yelk, if you've ever seen it, I tried to get you part of it, but I guess they pulled it.
Came out.
Like, oh, did it?
The part that was on 60 Minutes came out.
Yeah. So some people thought it was an exploitation of a desperate guy, Yelk, the man who was asking for help. So that's what the thing swirled around. No one came to arrest him.
That was very disturbing.
Yeah.
Watching that.
Yeah.
It's like you're murdering somebody.
And it was murdering somebody at dinner time Sunday night.
Yeah, it was like, this is really bizarre.
Mm-hmm. So kids are watching, there's all kinds of people. I, you know, myself saw it after watching my fifth concussion-inducing NFL football game. You know, you sort of sit there all day long and say, now they're going to kill somebody on TV. You say, really? I thought they were doing that for the past 10 hours. But anyway, so it was controversial. And
his wife mentioned that he was a private person,
yes,
in the interview, so I
thought that was problematic. And Wallace came in for a lot of criticism about this. There was a panel discussion at the University of Michigan that I went to and Wallace went to, and Kevorkian's lawyer was at, and at the time it was a very heated topic about whether it should have been broadcast at all.
Wallace suffered severe depression, and he may well have thought the public should know about this.
If it ever got there,
is available.
You know, I couldn't tell what his personal views were, but that's just journalists, you know, being journalists.
Did Kevorkian ever charge a fee?
No, never charged a fee. Got some money sent to him for his activities. Donors backed him up, but he never charged. At one point, they took away his license, so he had problems getting access to equipment. That was in another video clip that you made that I think ran. So he had to go through other people to get him his chemicals, because he couldn't get them himself. But he charged, and he had to pay for this stuff and pay for his life and his expenses. I can say, with a lot of authority, having met him, talked to him, testified against him, known him, that he was a very frugal guy. He had no interest in publicity for himself. I mean, like selling books or any of that kind of thing that wasn't him. He thought he was doing a good thing. He would use publicity to advance his cause, but he wasn't personally, whether he was on Oprah, mattered not a whit to him. Couldn't care less. Very, almost a private guy himself, too, in some ways, oddly enough.
Did he ever get a second opinion to make certain that these people were truly in need of his services?
No. I once asked him, one of the people he helped to die was a woman who'd been in psychiatric institutions, and I said, did you, you know, ever try to establish what her mental status was, given this long history? He said, that's not my job. My job is to honor what my patients want. So it's sort of, you know, you can sort of say to them, look, some of your patients may not know what they want because they may be depressed or they may be disturbed. I always thought Thomas Yauch was really, he might have used some help before he decided to end his life. Not that he wouldn't have still decided that, but he hadn't gotten a lot of social or psychological support. One other little item of interest, about 3/4 of the people that Kevorkian assisted were female. Not clear what that was all about. Never sort of, did they seek him out more because they felt more depressed for various reasons? Was it an accident of the drug? I don't know. He never had, as far as I know, an African-American person go to him. He had some minority, other minority people did. Almost overwhelmingly white people, middle class, not rich. Not desperately poor either, though. I don't know what the religious affiliation were of the 60 public cases. There were some people who were religious. His first case, Janet Atkins, was someone who had been told by her doctor he was certain she had Alzheimer's. And she was in good shape when she found him and requested help in dying, and he helped her die. But on the autopsy, they didn't see any sign of Alzheimer's. So that was always claimed to be a misdiagnosis. Again, I don't know. Her husband said he didn't regret it. She didn't want to face even the risk of getting Alzheimer's. But if you're facing the risk of getting Alzheimer's, that puts everybody in this room into the, you know, sort of category of, but she became a big issue on the diagnostics, as it wasn't confirmed later. And they were the classic first instance, I have to say, Unitarian Universalists, you know, she was upset that she wasn't going to be able to play the piano anymore, and they used to like to meet on the porch in Seattle and have a blueberry muffin together. It was sort of like, oh my God, they're going to kill every Quaker. it was like the American Friends Service Committee sent these people straight to Jack of Orchid. But the husband never, as I said, he never expressed any regret on that one. There were other much more dubious cases of people with mental illness. He helped a 300-pound woman to die who wasn't otherwise in bad health, and clearly, you know, she was troubled. And remember, Kevorkian's view was not physician-assisted suicide for the terminally ill. It was physician-assisted suicide for those who desire it, which is a pretty broad... You're sweeping in a lot of folks. This isn't Washington, Oregon, 6 months to live by two doctors, confirm kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't know enough of the story about it. Why wasn't he prosecuted for this if this was illegal everywhere?
Well, the first couple of cases, there were no laws against the book in Michigan against assisted suicide. Strangely, there was a law in the book in a couple of states against suicide. Very difficult to enforce. If you succeed, it's hard, and if you fail, most people don't want to drag you into court. So they had no law. 20 states had no laws on the books, Michigan being one, that prohibited assisted suicide. It was silent. It's not that they said it's okay, it just never passed a law. So for a while, that's why he was where he was, and that's why he was rolling along. Then the Michigan legislature passed a law, but he kept going, and at that point there was another trial, and the jury and judge refused to convict him. The willingness of the patient, the ethics of what was going on, they took his license, but they didn't send him to jail. That's when he lost his medical license.
Did Kevorkian ever turn a patient down?
Yes.
Under what circumstances, do you happen to remember? I'm just curious.
Children.
Well, adults, I
not sure. Don't know about adults. He definitely turned out children. There were requests that came from about teenagers with cystic fibrosis and this sort of thing. Wouldn't do that. I'm not sure he wouldn't have done it. He wouldn't have done it politically. It was not where he was going to start. That's not where he was going. So, we have our distinctions laid out in terms of what's the conceptual categories. Let me say... that we'll take a little break. I want to say something about do not resuscitate. And then I'm going to ask you to take a look at what the disability community has said about this whole area of activity, particularly in response to a proposal to put a Washington and Oregon state kind of law in the books. And for those of you who didn't track this through all the readings, just to remind you, Washington and Oregon are physician-assisted suicide states with medicines provided, lethal doses. Two people who are terminally ill, as pronounced by two doctors, although interesting enough, it could be an allergist and a dermatologist. There isn't actually a qualification on who can pronounce you terminally ill. You're not supposed to live for more than 6 months. Best judgment. You could, you know, people understand it's a judgment. You could be wrong, but you're trying to make an honest appraisal.
Can that be done by a dermatologist or an allergist as well?
Mm-hmm. You must report it to the police, the death. You are able to void any restrictions on your life insurance so that if you have it, it's not made moot by your suicide, which normally you would lose your insurance. You have to have a psychological or psychiatric assessment before you can use it, and you have to wait, I believe it's 2 weeks from the time the medicine prescription is put in to the time you could use it, so it's not filled quickly. And Washington and Oregon basically have similar things. Yeah. Holland and Belgium are much more liberal, more doctor discretion in the Kevorkian model about who to help die. Not restricted to terminal illness. Their triggers are pain and suffering. Some of the people that were saying maybe are questionable in terms of Kevorkian killing them, despondency, might make it in Holland or Belgium. They might. Even if you said, but they're mentally unstable, but they're really despondent. It's kind of up to the physician to make the call a little bit. When I looked at Washington, Oregon, when Oregon first came up in 1997, I was a critic because I thought it would be abused and that people would say, Grandma, you're sucking up the kids' college tuition, you're terminally ill, I think you should sign up to take these pills and leave us now. Or, we don't have any money, here's a way out for you. In fact, I don't think any of that has happened. I don't think there's been any abuse that way. I don't know of any single instance in which anybody has ever said, the police or, you know, this thing gets looked at by the health department every year to see what's going on too. The critics of the Oregon law keep saying there's hanky-panky, but the independent assessment doesn't really prove or provide any reason to think that that's been true. But what amazes me is, at least in Oregon and Washington, relatively few people take their pills. Yeah. Also, so a lot of people get them.
Also, they have a residency requirement.
Yes, so you can't do euthanasia tourism, so to speak. But even with that, a tiny number of people swallow those pills. They like knowing that they could, gives them control, but they don't do it. And I would not have ever predicted that. I'm not sure anybody would have. It turns out that you could argue that Oregon and Washington have prevented more suicides,
yes,
by having the availability of a means to die at your fingertips than they have encouraged people to end their lives. So I thought that to me, that's been one of the really interesting outcomes of looking at how those have operated. Relatively few doctors participate. I mean, we'll write the scripts, but they don't need a lot.
I remember when they analyzed the first few years, Austin was primarily a choice of upper class white people. And I wondered if it's now crossing lower socioeconomic classes as well.
It's funny. Oregon and Washington are the states that are probably among the most non-minority in the country, and they also, by polls, have the least religious affiliation of the people. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were going to put this through in Massachusetts, you were going to have one interesting discussion with the Catholic Church. Now, the Catholic Church has put up with the Kennedys over the years, so I'm not saying you can't win these fights, but it'll still be an interesting discussion in a different way. I'm from Massachusetts. I understand the state somewhat. My parents are still there. My sisters all live there. I am constantly bombarded with oddball. I mean, Mitt Romney was there. What more do I need to say? But it'll be a different game. So I don't think there's been a big shift because the makeup of the places isn't that. It's like, you know, if you had it in Minnesota, you just wouldn't see that many minority people coming through. I don't know, but I, with certainty, but I don't think so. I think it's still been pretty much white, middle class, folks, the rich tend to be in home care, special nursing, not doing this. Oregon and Washington, too, have pretty good health coverage. Not universal, but it's pretty good, so there aren't that many people bumping around in the uninsured pool. If this was Texas, it might look a little different as well.
But Montana also has the assistant suicide.
By a court saying there's nothing to stop it. It's a little bit like Michigan's there's no law against assisted suicide. Somewhat like that. Unless the legislature wants to pass such a law, there's nothing to stop it. But they don't have any of the protections in place that Oregon and Washington have.
I looked at the racial composition of the people who actually chose to end their lives for one of Nora's classes. And in the past 5 years, I think there have been 3 non-white out of maybe 120, something like that. And it was 1 Hispanic person, 1 Asian, and these are broad categories that I don't know how they're assigned, but and 1 Native American, no African American in the history of the whole program.
Well, I can say this, and then I'll let us break out for 5 minutes. In my talks around the country on this subject, I've gone to a lot of African American churches and some African American colleges and civic groups just talking about this subject. And they are the most hostile to assisted suicide, sometimes on religious grounds, but often on trust grounds. It's sort of like, you know, my shorthand version for this is it might be nice in America at least to have the right to health care before you have, it might be nice to have the right to see the doctor before you create the right to have the doctor kill you. And you get some of that, you know, people say, I'm not sure. Same thing comes up, by the way, in organ donation. Minority rates are lower, and it's somewhat a trust issue.
Is it covered? Is it a covered service under Medicare?
In Oregon, it is. The expenses are covered. So it's if you need Medicaid, it will pay. It doesn't pay generously. It's not an incentive, but yeah, they do pay. Well, it's odd because it's one of the few things. Remember we had that fight in the U.S. about whether or not you would pay doctors to talk about advanced directive planning? In Oregon, they will have that. They pay you to have the discussion.
Yeah,
that's what, I mean, there's no expenses. It's just putting pills on a shelf. So yeah, it's a talk conversation payment. I was almost tempted to bring that up in the middle of the debate about the other thing, but then I thought, maybe not the best analogy. But it is paid for as a conversation. All right, 5 minutes.
My mother, my poor mother, so my parents had a second standard by themselves. So my mother had to ask for questions. And my father gave her a lot of money. And she was really upset because it was not the money that the other the grandchildren got the night before. She thought she was worth a lot more. My dad pretty
I'm interested in
doing
like
the history of MPAS, but I'm trying to think like
versus playing
like the paper guidelines. It's supposed to be like a history of.
I want you to touch on it.
Touch on
it. You can come contemporary, but just sort of say 30 years ago when this all started, the debate was about that, and I've been out to that, and this is what they're talking about. Today we've gotten all the way over to here. Now that we're here, what does this mean? So I want to nod to it. If you can use it a little more than that, say... back then they were arguing about this. And they're still arguing about this today.
Right.
That's okay.
Got it.
So you don't have to wallow.
Got it.
Bring it to bear.
Got it. Okay.
Bring it to the there. So, yeah.
I mean, the places change.
I don't know. He told me that he would have a Cheesecake Factory. Does that make sense?
I don't remember there being a Cheesecake Factory, but I thought which was 5 years ago. So, yeah. It could easily be in Stanford Shopping Center, which is like the big shopping center right now.
Steve, I know those. I will send them out. I know them partly because I escaped ultimate condemnation.
I did. It was 3 days ago. A buddy of mine sent me.
Oh, did he? Yeah. You're right. We can put those in. So that's the right wing critique as opposed to the
right. No. Most of my friends have no idea what I'm doing. You know, so they're like, every time they
listen for about 25 years, my parents had no idea what I was doing. So what are you doing? What is it doing?
What's interesting? I just found out I'll actually be working on what to read.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that'll be good. My title will be Chaplain Clinical Ethicist. I'm going to send you the
I'd like to see the
military.
Job.
Yeah, I don't know if you know. In the military, we have what's called an OER support form.
Yeah.
So one side is your written job description by your commander and you together, and then you get rated off that. I'll send that to you.
Send me that. I'd love
very
to see
interesting.
That.
There's a kind I'd of excited it. About it.
And you know, I know all about Walter Reed. You know, my wife is ran the Philly. She was the CEO of the Philly VA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And she's now the head of the Once Fair Scranton VA.
Okay.
So I know Walter Reed and the VA
right.
interact a lot, shall we say. Or put it this way, whatever's wrong with Walter Reed, they blame on the VA and vice versa.
Right, exactly.
People say, oh, this terrible scandal. Yeah. Walter Reed, they say, oh, that VA, they're out of control. I said, no.
I'm excited about it. A couple of things. It'll be a 3-year job, which is nice.
Do you think getting the bioethics thing helped? Hurt or they
well, it was mandated.
Oh, so they wanted.
That's
okay.
The whole. That's the primary reason why I'm here. I mean, I've spent the last 10 years pretty much over there or coming back there. So, you know, I said, you know what? They're giving me an option to stay home with a 50% chance to end up home. So that's what we did. So it's kind of a different. I mean, the other option would have been when I chose bioethics. The other option would have been BAMC out in San Antonio. Both great places.
So
we were happy. It's great. I was able to leave my family at home. We didn't have to move again. So I commute up.
So you're
going to
live around D.C.?
Yeah, that's where I live. That's where I've
so been. You've been coming up.
Since 2005, I've been in D.C. is when I first went there and worked for some units that don't have public names and did some other cool stuff. Actually worked in Arlington for
a
year.
The reason I know something about this weaponizing room is I don't know if Java mentioned this to you, but I've been the ethics guy for DARPA for the past
Year.
So they're all spooks. And
yeah.
That's why I know.
Yeah. What do they do at Plum Island? Because I grew up right by Plum Island.
I can't tell you.
Yeah.
But what you think they do, they probably do.
Yeah, I know that they have. I had a couple friends who, got a job cutting grass in the summers out there, and they were like, and they told us, every disease on the planet is there.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
Although, to tell you the truth, I can tell you this, it's not really a weapons place.
It's research,
a real gigantic bio lab research place. So, there's 15 particularly creepy bugs, and they were all
interesting. So, I grew up on the North Fork.
DARPA, on the other hand, is a lot more interesting.
The other
well,
stuff.
Yeah. Can we target things to people of a particular genetic type and other such oddities?
Right. Yes, that's why I'm here, is to get the bioethics degree so I can actually work in that job.
at Walter Reed. I have to think about this. I'll let you know if and who I know at Walter Reed. I did know a couple of characters there on the medical side of the chapel.
Okay.
But they were interested in biologics. So.
Yeah, this will be the first. It's really not even a chaplain job. I mean, I think they select chaplains for it because we tend to be pretty neutral.
Oh, I see. I see.
You know what I mean?
So, yes, I do.
It's going to be.
It's the reason I was at this flu meeting. I was like, you're neutral.
Right.
You tell us what the hell it all meant.
And so I think that's the reason why, is because we already have a big background in ethics training, and, you know, and we take a balanced religious view as well. So we tend to be the ones with the least amount of agenda. So I think that's the reason why.
Yeah.
We'll find out. I have a meeting next week to actually go.
That is, ironically, a very common role for bioethicists.
Yeah.
I chaired a panel on animal research, what to do to set up guidelines many years ago for better handling animals.
Right.
I have a dog, but I don't really know much about the animals.
Don't put them on your roof.
I don't put them on my roof. But I mean, I don't know. But they said, well, you're neutral, so you can share it because you don't have a, should I say, dog in the fight. You know, I was like, yeah, I guess that's true. I'm not pro-research. I'm not anti.
Right.
So, yeah, you do get the, you get thrust in that. You're the arbiter.
Right.
Mediator kind of thing.
Right. It'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
I like to, yeah, keep me informed about it.
Oh, I definitely will. Yep.
Next week, when you come, we will have a break next week, and I will feed you. I will feed you pizza or salad or sandwiches. Yes, I'm sensitive to the idea that some of you may not want just cheese on bread. This is not the army, as they say. So I try to vary it up a little bit. But for those of you looking to eat cheaply, we'll do that next week. That may give us a chance as we kick around the bioethics things for me to really bore you with war stories like the flu meeting, because I got oodles of them out of the corporate end of things. But, well, that'll be up to you. We can sort of head that off in a direction. Steve told me, and he sent me something I'll make sure to get out, which I'd forgotten to post. Most of the readings next week are what I would call left-wing critiques of bioethics. They're sort of don't deal with industry, keep pure. But there is a right-wing critique of industry that says too liberal, killing babies, Peter Singer, infanticide, just sort of lost its ethical marbles completely. Either ignore the bioethicists or let's recapture bioethics and put it to more ethical good.
Right.
And I've got a couple of those articles that he reminded me about, so I'll be sending those out to you to take a look at too. So there are both right and left wing or liberal conservative, I don't know what it is. Anyway, both ends of something are coming in here as criticism. I should also add, bioethicists have been remarkably inept at defending anything they do. I don't know why that is. They can attack and critique everything else. I can't muster up 9 words about why they think. I mean, I'm tipping my hand here, but the problem with it, should you talk to industry problem, is, well, about what? I'm talking to industry right now. Some of you may know Johnson & Johnson is short on a drug called Doxil. They had a manufacturing problem. It's an ovarian cancer treatment, last-ditch treatment. They have to ration it. They want help. I don't have 5 seconds of hesitancy to say, yeah, if you want to hire me to give you advice about how to distribute the scarce supply of this drug, I'm happy to do it. On the other hand, maybe it's not such a good idea to be the advisor to, you know, the let's promote baldness remedy program. I don't know, whatever less lofty thing, or just, you know, helping them defend themselves against critics or something. If it's a straight up, how do we deal with the scarcity? It isn't even their plant. It's somebody else's plant that they use to make this stuff that went offline. To me, that seems to be a very good thing to do. As I said to somebody else, it seems a good thing to do, and I'll be damned if I'm going to give my charity to Johnson & Johnson to do it. They can pay me. I'll do the, you know, I'll do the foundation for free. I'm not doing the Johnson & Johnson for free. So, what are we talking about? That sort of thing becomes a more interesting issue to me. All right, quickly on DNR, and I'm going to do this fast just to make sure we don't stay here till 10 tonight. Do not resuscitate was probably the first area where people got into a battle about not so much helping somebody to die, but allowing somebody to die. And we haven't said as much today about the allowing to dies. But it was of keen concern if I chose to not give you cardiopulmonary resuscitation or not to apply the paddles or not to give you heart massage, was I assisting in your suicide? This was an old problem that people began to sort of debate, because if I said, I would like you not to resuscitate me anymore, isn't that a request that's similar to, please kill me? Or for those who remember earlier parts of the course, active versus passive. If you see them as equivalent, I don't really have to, you know, inject you with potassium chloride in your heart. I can just say, I'm not doing anything, and you'll be dead, and I'm sure you will be dead, and so I'm helping you die by not keeping you going. Well, I think a lot of people still wanted to draw a distinction between actively doing something to bring about death and passively deciding not to attempt a resuscitation. One key difference is if the patient fools you and doesn't die, you then don't kill them. So there are room. There's a room for error. There's an uncertainty of result that isn't there. Jack Kevorkian, if he didn't kill you with the thanatron, was going to put a pillow on your head. I mean, you weren't coming out alive. The point was to make you dead. In a non-resuscitation thing, if your heart starts up again, nobody's going to jump on top of you and say, oh, well, you know, you said don't resuscitate, you got to die now. So there does seem to be something different about the two courses of action, where one might withhold something at a patient request, knowing they're likely to die, but not with absolute certainty. And if they don't, then you still don't move on to make sure that they do die. Versus assisted suicide really has the goal, if the machine doesn't work right, you're going to try and do something to fix it and make it work right, or pursue some other line of action. So I've always felt there is a difference between the active and the passive in this regard, although there are plenty of people who still say, yeah, but for some cases, you know, withholding a resuscitation from a super frail person who's had multiple arrests, you know they're going to die. It's certain. So you are doing the same thing. You can't make that distinction. That may be true, but that doesn't mean you can't make the distinction about other behaviors that might fall into the same active-passive thing. Anyway, do not resuscitate. Mary and I were talking about this. It has a very interesting angle about what makes it a little more different, because what makes do not resuscitate different is that you have to ask a physician to write the order not to do it. Do not resuscitate is a physician order. It's you're requesting somebody to write an order that says, don't resuscitate me. It's not the same as saying, I'm going to write an advance directive saying, don't treat me. That's information that the physician might find interesting, or if you wrote one that said, do treat me, they could take that into account as part of your informed consent. But as do not resuscitate order is something that a doctor decides to put in your chart. They might do it because you request it, but it's possible that they might do it because they think it's the right thing to do. All right? We've resuscitated Mr. Smith. This is his 10th heart attack. We're not going to open up his chest and cause him to suffer anymore. We're going to write a DNR order here. How many of you have seen or written a DNR order without a patient request?
There is a... My mom has been very sick, and she was in this place for special care. And they give me a form, and in the form you had to say,
yes,
that you don't want...
Now, institutions often ask, what's your view about DNR? But my point is, physicians sometimes write them anyway. Or to put it another way, physicians might decide, we're not going to resuscitate you again. Or to put it another way, if you watch television, where I get all my big medical information from, after the people on Grey's Anatomy make their 58th effort to resuscitate a handsome young person who's been chewed on by a lion last week, I actually hate the show, but my wife watches it. Really hate it. But anyway, so they resuscitate, and then somebody's got to call the end. Somebody's got to say, we're done here, right? Do they ask you? No. They may say, we're not going to resuscitate any further because we think death has come or we think that it's pointless. Somebody ends resuscitation efforts always. And often it is the attending, often, always, it is the attending physician who makes that determination.
I am having a great difficulty understanding DNR. Mm-hmm. I really don't understand it because, first of all, how it could be done without a patient consent.
So you might say this person's unconscious but having a lot of heart attacks. They have no family.
Wait a sec. We work and work and work and have debates and debates and debates about people in PBS situations. Mm-hmm. And is it really possible that a physician can I'm really asking this as a question, can unilaterally make a decision?
Sure, not to resuscitate? Yes.
So how?
To pull out your feeding tube? Probably not.
What is the ethical underpinning of that?
Resuscitation?
One of the things, at least the way I did it, was to present the family as saying, I think that we've done everything we can. I think at this point we should not do any more, and I think we should not resuscitate him if he has another arrest. And that takes the burden off the family to make the decision to withdraw support, because I'm taking responsibility saying it's my medical opinion treatment is futile, and therefore I don't think we should.
What does futile mean?
Well, here's something for futile. What's the success rate of resuscitation?
That's a different question.
No, just say.
I don't know.
It's about 5 to 15% in the hospital.
For discharge.
But if you are 89, multiple illnesses, respiratory failure, got a lot of life support keeping you going, and you arrest, and you have no relatives, do I have to go in and resuscitate you then?
Why is that different than any other treatment that you would decide to
do? This is where history was so interesting. So CPR became established, 1960 was published, and it was shown that you could turn around someone who had an acute event, maybe from anesthesia or some acute event. So the initial reports, it was very successful. Now again, if you think about consent, if I've just had a cardiopulmonary arrest, I can't say, yo, poke me. So you presume consent. Then as they started assuming that you do this on everyone, along with the whole technological imperative, we've got 7 infusions, it's keeping your heart going, we've got, you get into multi-organ system failure, the whole evolution of chronic illness that we're keeping people alive that, we never would have before. In the 70s and 80s, you get into all that confusion about, what are we doing here? Somebody's got metastatic cancer. They're not eligible for a heart transplant. They have terminal cardiac disease. Do we keep coding them? So then you got into, we really don't want to do this.
Let me add one other bit of history. So every person has a do not resuscitate decision made for them that dies in the hospital. Because you could try something else. You could try to massage their heart, try to do something to them one more time. The tradition is that doctors decide when it's time to stop. And I can tell you, and some of the medical students here will know, depends on what floor you're on. Sometimes depends if it's a kid. You might be trying a lot harder with a kid than a 90-year-old. Or a very sick 90-year-old. But it's always been a doctor-determined decision regarding resuscitation when you stop.
Okay.
That's a unique category. It's not a doctor determined decision if you, put a ventilator on somebody as to when you take it off. That's been more of a patient team negotiation. But resuscitation by necessity, when you finally say we're done here, doctor driven. So the CPR techniques and other things fell into that area of doctor determined resuscitation, and that's why it's got that. I understand what you're bribing against, is why is this special, but it's because doctors have always had to say, we tried and we can't do this anymore, so we're giving up now.
So that's different, there's a futility in that we don't think. My
Correct.
Best medical judgment, and this is really from a point of view of trying to understand it, I can understand a medical judgment, I don't think, we've tried 10 times and blah, 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 but I don't understand the DNR order. If somebody has terminal cancer and they want to live, okay, and then they, it appears to me, are asked that question. Do you want it? Why are they asked that question?
But do you want a DNR?
They get better. They know they're terminal. Why does that become a question for them or for older people? So in one facility that I'm recently aware of, everybody over 80 is asked if you have a DNR, if you want a DNR or order. Why?
So I can tell you I've been in three different academic institutions. The first two, every single person is admitted to the hospital. So, you know, if this young, healthy buck was admitted to the hospital, he would be asked if he wanted a DNR order. And again, I think it revolves around this idea that there is no informed consent. So, you know, you can't go to the person when... So I might be able to go to you and say, do you want dialysis or kidneys are failing? Here are the pros, here are the cons. Oh, your heart is stopped. You know, do you want me to press on your chest or not? That's not a conversation that can happen in real time. And so I think that's behind it. But I did have another question.
And by the way, just to follow that point, and the request about DNR status followed on the evolution of the advanced directive. So they are mixing. But historically, doctors had to make the determination on people who couldn't communicate to them. So that was there's always been a doctor-driven part of resuscitation or last steps end of life.
I guess my other question revolved around when you say it's the doctor's decision. I mean, my experience has been, you know, we do the kind of heavy-handed, you know, like, here's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But if the family doesn't agree with our opinion, we still go full code. And I'm trying to think of it. I can't think of an instance where...
But you might have somebody just dying in front of you, and the family says, do everything, and you still say, my God, the damage to these organs is overwhelming, we can't, and you'd stop, right?
So I guess you'd initiate, I'm just thinking about maybe more concrete terms, you'd initiate the code, but at some point you're right.
You have to give it out.
And
that's the only angle I'm trying to capture about why this is different. At some point, somebody's got to say, we can't do this anymore, stop working. That's the futility side.
But that's different from putting a DNR order on.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
But it evolves out of this past. Then comes things like the living will, control over what's done to you, and the idea that you could give directions before you wind up in extremis, unconscious, no family, blah, blah, blah. Now you can start to tell us a little more, and pretty soon DNR and resuscitation are moving more toward ventilators, dialysis, other things that you might do. Now, there's always been a nest of resistance to that, meaning in a lot of facilities, DNR still might be able to be written on someone without their permission or consent if they had no one to speak for them. If the doctors really thought it was completely futile to try and, you know, their heart is so weak that we can't. It's just, if that stops, that's going to be it because we can't get it back. So there has been an attempt to carve out on futility grounds, doctor-driven DNR. Very small, tiny, tiny, tiny space, but it is there. So historically, DNR starts as something the doctors do to end all efforts to resuscitate. Then comes CPR. That works great, except pretty soon it's realized it doesn't work that great. In fact, it doesn't work well at all. It depends on how sick you are and healthy or frail and many other things. So then you get into a situation where you're having people write orders, put them in charts, sometimes with blue dots. This is the famous, we're going to chart you as DNR, but not tell you that you're DNR. This happened. Then people push back against that and say, look, if you're competent and able, you should have a discussion about resuscitation too. We want that as part of what you could give consent to even before you get into these bad situations. So you get more of a mixing of advanced directive, living will type stuff with DNR, including DNR. But that's the evolution.
I have to say that in my practice, I never have had to make that decision myself. It's always been patient
initiated.
And the patient will make it very, very clear. I've had it. I've had a great life. Don't do anything. That's usually the way.
I'm not saying that isn't the dominant one.
I understand. And the other thing about there never being family, I can't remember a patient that didn't have somebody, whether it was a friend, cousin, but there was always somebody available that you could talk about the situation and what your thoughts really were.
I've had plenty where that hasn't been the case. Working in an inner city hospital, I've had a case where he didn't have family.
I was reading the paper about Katrina,
with the evacuation, the hospital that they had to evacuate and mm-hmm. had to triage who is going to be. So they said that the hospital had a 7th floor that was dedicated to a specific terminally ill people. So when it came, when they realized that they lost the power, lost the generator, everything, they had to make a decision who should go. So a nurse finally took the decision and said, well, anybody who has a DNR is going to stay, and every other, the other ones we are going to try to evacuate. And there was the issue of somebody who was too heavy that couldn't get
them out.
To bring somebody from the 7th floor down to where the helicopter was waiting. So I was a little annoyed about the DNR that those people were labeled, you will be the last to live.
Yep, that certainly might be a contentious way to make the decision, because there are certainly people who would say the way you're solving this is to euthanize them. Right, it wasn't just leave them alone. So some people argued you just should have left them there and let them take their chances. If rescue came, good. Is DNR the same as saying I don't want to live?
No.
Not always. Not always. I'm not making this up. I did have a case. One of my former med students called me once from Syracuse and said, you're going to love this. Somebody literally did kick out the cord on somebody's, I forget if it was a ventilator or something, but they knocked out accidentally the power on a DNR person. They said, should we put it back? And I said, absolutely. They're not, you know, this isn't what they had in mind. It's sort of that wasn't the dream here. So DNR isn't necessarily a statement that I don't want to live. It's maybe I don't want to go through something in order to live, or don't wail on me. Let me just thicken this up slightly. Just watch the time here. There are DNRs. I pulled one out here from Texas. That is the out-of-hospital DNR. So you might buy a little bright bracelet today that says don't resuscitate me.
EMTs are trained never to resuscitate.
Right. So here's, I was going to say, so here's the Texas law. An intact, easily identifiable plastic identification thing that has the word Texas or a geographical shape of Texas, that's very Texan, and the words do not resuscitate shall be honored by qualified EMS personnel. Let's see here. I want to see what the problem is. There's no penalty if you don't. It says you should honor it, but it doesn't say what happens if you don't honor it. Generally speaking, I think do not resuscitate has a lot of play. There's play for it in the hospital, for sure, but there's a lot of people out in the community are saying, you know, if I fall over my treadmill, don't resuscitate me. I'm 94 years old. I just don't want to be resuscitated for whatever reason. I don't want to. This is it for me. Let me go. If you call 911, there's a pretty good chance that you will be resuscitated. One of the things we have to try and convince people to do is if they have that bracelet, tell their loved one not to call anybody. As soon as they're hitting the phone, all hell breaks loose because the EMTs show up and they're sort of like, did he mean it? Did he mean it? I don't know. What do you think? They're hitting it. And they start jumping around pretty quick. And I'm not saying that's the wrong attitude. I think it's good to have ambulance and EMT people who are aggressive. I'm not arguing against that. But it does make for a world of confusion if you trigger the response system to come. But a lot of people are interested these days in out of hospital. Or out of institute, out of nursing home, DNR. There's a movement to tattoo yourself or put bracelets, headbands, I don't know.
Chain yourself to the bed.
Chain yourself to the bed. Can't take me away. that has been going on. And you see a lot of stories appearing in the newspapers now. I pulled one out from San Jose. This is, it starts off this way. Bill Newman has seen his share of hospitals. That's why he plans never to go back. If I fall over, just let me go. No bells, no whistles, said 87-year-old retired high school teacher and double bypass survivor. So he wears a do not resuscitate badge to his 6:15 a.m. gym workouts. He posted the same DNR message on his refrigerator. I'm sure they'll be looking there. Shared it with his doctor and his 10 children. That's better. But my point is, this guy isn't trying to die. When we asked about DNR, and he's going to the gym, I assume. He's trying to live. But should things not work out, then he's kind of sending a message of a different sort. So DNR does not mean I've given up. I don't, you know, your problem with it as a criteria is probably true. Here's a guy who's got a DNR order who's at the gym every day. So I assume, you know, he's trying to say, should I get close to death, let me go. But otherwise, we'll try to put that off for a little while longer. So I think that gets mixed up, too, in terms of what DNR means.
But I was going to say, for, you know, being on the other side of it, there are two areas of ambiguity that I see a lot. One is the living will problem, and the majority of them are phrased, you know,
yes,
so poorly that you can't really do anything with it. So they're, you know, in the event that I'm not going to survive or I have very little chance of surviving, I wouldn't want anything done. And patients present us or families present us with these as though this is a fait accompli, and we look at the person, we're like, I don't know, you know, it's 40, 60, 30.
Lawyers here, do you have to honor an advance directive, or is it information?
If it's done with capacity, why wouldn't you honor it? If it's ambiguous...
Why wouldn't you honor it, or do you legally have to do it?
Yes. Well, it depends on what the legislation is in the state.
Correct. So often, it's just advisory. Just information to take into account.
And I know in... So, I don't know nationally, but again, your family has the right to overturn anything.
No, that can't be.
Well, put that on hold because that's war in its own right. But all I want to say is it's a little bit similar to the penalties that EMTs face. If you don't honor it, it's very hard to sue and say, you kept me alive. How dare you? We've seen a couple of those lawsuits tried. They don't get very far. The penalty, you know, it's sort of like, well, you know, what are the damages for me still being here? Even if I'm suffering, it's kind of, the courts don't like to say, you know, they should be penalized for keeping you alive. So in general, there aren't severe penalties for not honoring them. You're right to point out, too, they often get written like, I don't want to suffer. I don't either. but, you know, sort of, what's that all about? Well, if I have to get a herpes zoster vaccination, I don't want to suffer, but they make me suffer, so it comes through a needle. They're often vague. So what's a remedy for vague information about your wishes to the advanced directive recipe model?
Control.
So probably better, if you're trying to manage this, to figure out, can they assign some responsibility to a trusted loved one or agent to make decisions for them. I found the living wills often ignored, hard to find sometimes too, and then vague when they get there. It's a little easier to have somebody, at least you know, has been designated to act for the person, if that's possible. It's also nice to encourage people to tell the person they designate that they've been designated. It's also nice to update it. I've seen not a few cases in which your former spouse is now still on the paper as the designee. Might be risky. might be. And it's useful to have them not write down my family, which is also another fun road to screaming. So there are. I like the idea of having a spokesperson. A lot of people don't want to write recipes about the details of how they will die. Not a few fear that if they write it down, it'll happen. So there's some magical thinking about that sort of thing. So even though the advance directive, all the way back to our friend Nancy Kruzan, was felt to be a good way to allow people to act upon their values, it's turned out to be somewhat disappointing. It's expanded to include DNR, other information as technology moves. I mean, I don't know that many people are saying much about their LVAD today or flip off my defibrillator. I haven't seen too much of that in a living will. Should be, but I haven't seen much. But what I think has turned out to be perhaps a little more applicable is the surrogate decision maker. People had a lot of hope on the living will. I'm not sure it's delivered as much control or authority as originally was hoped for. A lot of people fill out their living will, their lawyer, and just the lawyer puts it away. And their family or others don't even know they have it. I've seen that too.
Most of this problem could be avoided if physicians got involved with their patients.
I understand.
On the legal side.
I understand. And it could be involved. We could get rid of some of this too if you would like transfer information from the nursing home to the hospital. It'd be nice to have electronic records everywhere that are linked, and many other things would be nice in that happy Wizard of Oz world of tomorrow. But it isn't there yet. So for now, one thing that we might say is that a bioethically inspired idea, the living will, perhaps didn't deliver as much control as it might in certain areas like DNR. It's partly because there's still tension about how much information to cede to the patient or the patient's family. In other areas, new technologies like defibrillators or LVADs or continuous renal replacement therapy, maybe people don't even think about it to put it on. And in other areas, people don't like to write them, or they lose them, or they are nervous to even try to write one because they worry about what that might mean. It's not their place. God will punish them. Somebody will, they'll anger the gods if they do it, that sort of thing. So there have been more obstacles here. You know, studies show that living wills have not been that effective, that they get ignored a lot, and there's a lot of pretty good empirical work on it. Still, people redouble their efforts often on the bioethics side to try and push them, but it might go further if they were sort of supplemented or added to the getting the decision maker clear. That would have helped, I think, even in things like Terri Schiavo. She had bothered to write down that she wanted her husband to be the decision maker, even though I would have thought that was the default, but okay. So that may be one way out. Then you don't have to get into all the boggy details of, you know, do you want this but you don't want that, and how would we do this, and so forth, which gets... I think civilians are not particularly... I'm not particularly good at laying out all the 400 scenarios that somebody might encounter at end-of-life care. Mm-hmm.
So the current thing that I understand with advanced care planning is that the primary thing is to name your substitute decision maker in writing, and you have the discussion of values with that person as opposed to which particular procedures, because this is changing every day and the likelihood. But if you talk, you have to pick somebody who you think will effectuate your wishes, and you talk to them about it.
Years ago, Zeke Emanuel had an idea about having a sort of living will with a format that had sort of checkoff boxes. But I don't think that worked either. It was like this forced choice thing that people didn't want to get into. So that didn't... I think the surrogates are kind of...
Well, I was going to say, in Pennsylvania, the law has two parts. This is what my preferences are, but who's the person? And if you don't appoint the person, Pennsylvania law, that person who, in the hierarchy that's in the law, who's your decision maker, does not have the same power as the person
who is appointed
around end-of-life care. So they are limited. Again, in Pennsylvania. So if I appoint someone, they could make any decision I would make, turn off the LVAD, you know, end it all. But the healthcare representative in Pennsylvania does not. And they're supposed to really earn and decide continuum life. And we always try to go for the conversation. I mean, Friday, we were calling a nursing home and saying, who helped them fill out this form? Talk to us about the conversation. What did they understand? And occasionally you'll see somebody doesn't want dialysis, they want everything else. And then you find out, oh, her brother was on dialysis. That's why they circled that. She didn't want... So it's like a scavenger hunt, but it is really, really important, particularly in Pennsylvania, to appoint someone. You don't have to tell them your thoughts, but...
I'll forego our Massachusetts thing. Maybe I'll get back to it next week to kick us off. But let me end today with something that I think I was talking to you about, Mary. We had a guy, this came from my wife, in the VA hospital. So there was a guy in there recently. He had been in bed for a long time, and as some of you know, that's a real recipe for getting ulcers and skin breakdowns and infections and death. He said it was painful to turn him, and he didn't want anybody to turn him anymore. Now, he knew that that was going to likely lead to big problems and death. The nurses didn't want to do that because they knew that was going to lead to a pretty yucky, disgusting situation that they didn't necessarily want to deal with. Plus, it's against standard of care. When you're laying out what you don't want, can you say, don't turn me over, don't take my vitals, don't turn the room lights on, how far out are we going here, and I don't have an exact answer. I looked up the do not turn issue just to see if anybody had written about it. I didn't see one article. But, you know, the notion of leave the thermostat off and I'll freeze to death in here, or don't cut my fingernails, don't give me a bath. I'm not sure how all of that sorts out relative to what might be considered required things to do to people by the state in a nursing home. You're going to get in trouble if there's pressure ulcers. They're going to be all over you. And it's going to be weird for you to say, well, I don't want to be turned. So, like, really? We don't care. You can't have that. So I don't know if there are limits at the other end of one's ability to direct one's care in institutional settings. I just don't know. I don't know where they run out. So it's an interesting dilemma if you sort of push it out at that end.
I think if you're capable, you can make any determination you want about your physical care or your treatment. So
I would think you could make the recommendation, but whether it gets honored, whether it gets penalized.
What, you know what you have to add to, what does it look like? So are clinicians going to go in there with a confident adult saying, don't do that to me, mm-hmm. do it. And you'll get all sorts of, because this comes up a lot, certainly mm-hmm. over my years. You know, are you really going to force them? Or is somebody going to pathologize and say, call psychiatry, they don't decision make.
Well, that's one out.
You know, and then, but, you know, somebody has to make it happen. So we do that pediatrics all the time. We make kids do things for their, you know, for their health if they don't want to.
I mean, we may need a document that says, I fully understand that if I'm not turned, it may lead people to not come in my room as much, it may lead to my death, but I indemnify you and don't turn me. I don't know.
But that's getting into legal analysis.
Sure, sure.
What's the right thing to do? Does the patient really understand? Have we done everything?
And I think the nurses are still going to say, this is not, this isn't some kind of ventilator. This is putting on a blanket. You know, what are you talking about? We don't withhold that ever.
You're looking at a relationship, physician-patient relationship, and is the patient entitled to compel the caregiver to provide substandard care?
Yeah.
And that's really what...
That's what's being asked.
The patient is the source of all control. Autonomy. It's my body. I mean, you could sort of walk through it ethically. It makes us uncomfortable, and then you want to say, maybe I don't want to participate.
Well, if they didn't eat, we try to get them to eat. But do we force-feed them? Rarely.
But again, some of these things have consequences. I mean, I actually agree with the patient-centered care because that's, you know, kind of one of our tenets. But if you look at it in the practical sense, as an example, pressure ulcers are no longer going to be reimbursed. So
sure.
Those are no longer going to be reimbursed. So a hospital...
That's because there's been a policy decision not to pay for errors.
Right, so a hospital's not going to get reimbursed for that care, which might make it difficult for them to meet their bottom line. And on the other hand, also, if you have a large proportion of people saying that, then the cost of the insurer will go up. So your peers are paying.